Mother Earth says, now take good care of me. Please do not hurt me. Hey, 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 oh. Hey, oh, hey, oh, hey, oh. And Father Sky says, now take good care of me. Please do not hurt me. Hey, 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 oh. Hey, oh, hey, oh, hey, oh. Creatures say, take good care of us. Please do not hurt us. Hey, 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 oh. Hey, oh, hey, oh, hey, oh. And we are here to be ourselves, to be with one another, to be with our surroundings, to be. And we are here to take care of ourselves, to take care of one another, to take care of our surroundings.
Greetings. You are listening to Wolf Mountain Radio's Honoring Mother Earth, Indigenous Voices, a production of the Yat-Kitishi Native American Center. We are broadcasting on RFPI, Radio for Peace International, Global Community Radio. Akwe, welcome. This is your host, Ones Pritzker. Wolf Mountain Radio focuses on protecting Mother Earth, defending Native lands and Indigenous peoples throughout the world. Honoring Mother Earth, Indigenous Voices presents the situations facing Native peoples throughout the world with Native news, interviews, music, commentaries, and investigative reports. This program serves to protect sacred Mother Earth and the traditional cultural lifeways of Indigenous peoples throughout the world. Please listen now to Honoring Mother Earth, Indigenous Voices. Ho, Kanawatakwasin, to all of our relations.
Guya wine, guya wine, guya wine, guya wine, guya wine, guya wine. Guya Yahweene, Guya Yahweene, Guya Yahweene, Guya Yahweene, Guya Yahweene. Guya Yahweene, Guya Yahweene, hi yo, ho,
music from Haudenosaunee Oneida singer-songwriter Joanne Shenandoah from her Silver Wave Records CD entitled The Best of Joanne Shenandoah. That particular song was entitled The Four-Legged Ones, an honor song to our animal relations. Today's program is part five of our very special conversation with community environmental activist Joy Ezell. Great greetings and hello, everyone. Welcome to Wolf Mountain Radio's Honoring Mother Earth Indigenous Voices. In today's program, we are honored to share a conversation with environmental community and peace activist Joy Ezell. Joy shares Yat-Kitishi Native Center's concern for protecting Mother Earth and promoting environmental social justice. Joy Ezell's activism exemplifies the important ethic of thinking globally and acting locally. Some of the issues she is fighting with her community organization include environmental, economic, and social impacts of the multinational corporation PG&E Buckeye Paper Mill, a proposed 800-megawatt coal-fired power plant, and United States military plans to locate a cruise missile bombing range in her area. These and other issues are topics of today's conversation when Joy visited us here at Yat-Kitishi Native Center. Yat-Kitishi Native Center's concern for protecting Mother Earth and the well-being of all life, in keeping with the indigenous ethic of caring for future generations, is why we are honored to be part of the worldwide environmental justice anti-globalization movement. Most every Wolf Mountain Radio program focuses on some aspect of defending our biosphere, as well as promoting sovereignty and self-determination of traditional cultures around the world. I personally have had the honor over the past 35 years to see firsthand and fight against many cases of environmental and social injustices in different parts of the globe. In my travels, I have met many fine and courageous people who are working to create a better world. Each Earth warrior I've met renews my energy to continue to defend Mother Earth. Joy Ezell is one such friend. Joy Ezell and I share a similar background and experiences as Earth justice activists. We both grew up in rural areas where agriculture and forestry dominate the political and economic society. Like feudal kingdoms, agribusiness and forest industries rule the region. Anyone who questions those dragons does so under great threat. As a forest ecologist who has spent much of my life fighting forest industries around the world who destroy and pollute traditional cultures and ecosystems, Joy Ezell's battle against the Buckeye Pulp and Paper Mill is particularly special to me. This company is responsible for serious environmental health impacts from their poisonous discharge effluents that contaminate the region's creeks and rivers and poison underground aquifer needed for drinking water. The mill also is the engine that drives the excessive and unsustainable cutting down of forests, raping the land. Historically, the landscape of the region now called North Florida, where Joy lives, was a beautiful ecosystem with a rich diversity of plant and animal species. Variations in topography, soil types, and hydrology created a unique watershed. It was first home to ancient culture peoples, such as the Apalaches, Tallahassees, Timucuas, and other tribal nations who lived in peace with nature. The arrival of Spanish explorers to the so-called New World did have an impact to the land, but the forest and wet prairie creek environment was still able to survive. Southeast Indians, who are now known as Florida Seminoles and Yuchi Creeks, for generations lived in harmony with this land. Early white settlers, like Joy Ezell's family, found the region a near paradise. Large cypress trees and longleaf pine, hardwood hammocks, marshes, creeks, and freshwater springs allowed rural communities to flourish. Coastal areas had the bounty of the Gulf of Mexico. Now this once beautiful area, like so many places around the world, is under assault. This biologically fragile area is quickly being destroyed. The unique old-growth forests have been cut down to feed the ever-demanding pulp and paper industry's greed for timber. PG&E's Buckeye Mill is like a giant vacuum cleaner sucking up the forests. It leaves a scarred landscape. So-called reforestation is nothing more than agro-industrial plantations, monoculture tree farms, which depend upon heavy inputs of chemical fertilizers, herbicides, and insecticides, now predominantly the landscape. Wiped out are the unique species of fauna and flora that once supported a diverse variety of wildlife. Hazardous waste, such as highly toxic dioxins, which are carcinogenic and mutagenic poisons, spew out from the Buckeye paper plant. These poisons greatly impact animal, plant, and human health. I first met Joy Ezell at a conference focusing on dioxin more than a decade ago. The conference, sponsored by the great citizen activist organization, Center for Health, Environment, and Justice, documented testimony from many grassroots groups that were and continue to battle corporate polluters. This great environmental justice organization, Center for Health, Environment, and Justice, under the leadership of our friend Lois Gibbs, still helps communities around the nation fight toxic waste sites. Lois, by the way, organized the Love Canal campaign against the infamous Hooker Chemical Company that contaminated her neighborhood in the 1970s. Not too long ago, I had the privilege to be a speaker with Lois Gibbs again at the 25th anniversary Legal Environmental Action Foundation Environmental Justice Conference in Tallahassee, Florida. On my way there, I had the opportunity to again visit the Buckeye plant to witness the paper mill's pollution. The situation that I have briefly described exemplifies many places throughout the world which are under attack by multinational corporations and government land use plans. While my conversation with Joy Ezell focuses on the region now called North Florida, the issues facing her community could be nearly anywhere in the world. Florida, in many ways, is like a so-called third world country. Much of the state is run by a government-corporate elite partnership. Forest industries, such as in Joy's Taylor County, phosphate mining in central Florida, or agribusinesses such as sugarcane, citrus, vegetables, and even cattle ranching in the region where I live, not to mention unsustainable urbanization, are greatly impacting the environment and human societies. It is also important to remember that Florida is still Dixieland, the Deep South. While there has been some cosmetic change in relations between the races, socioeconomic differences and perhaps more subtle segregation still exists, especially in the region where Joy Ezell is from. This makes her activism very special and very important. Yadkinishi Native Center is privileged to have Joy Ezell on our program today. In our conversation, I would like for you to share a little bit of personal background about your experience growing up in rural America, rural Florida. Your very interesting business card underneath your name says environmental activist, the organization HOPE, Help Our Polluted Environment. But I know you also share a lot of common concerns and experiences and even education about rural community development and agriculture, as I did. Would you please share some of your background in agriculture and rural community development, how you worked for chemical companies as a pesticide sales person after college, and that was really the catalyst that got you thinking and got you to become an environmental activist?
Grew up in Perry, Florida, up in Taylor County, up in North Florida. Grew up on a farm, went off to school and studied agricultural business, and went to work for a chemical company and sold some of the worst agricultural chemicals that there were known to man, some FMC Ag Chemicals. This is the company that I worked for first. Got to learn a whole lot about different kinds of chemicals and what they did, and I was afraid that I was ruining the environment. And this was way back in the 70s now, so it was a long time ago. I got really worried about what I was doing about the environment, and I thought that I was doing the wrong thing. And so I went back to school and got my master's, and unfortunately I went to work for another chemical company and sold even worse chemicals than I did to start off with. But it taught me a whole lot, because when I moved back home in 1981, first thing my grandmother told me was that the water was polluted at home in Taylor County. And I said, what are you talking about, Mama? And she said, well, Buckeye's in the water. You know, you can't drink the water down here anymore because it's got Buckeye. And what she meant was the paper mill effluent was in the water, that they had contaminated the aquifer. And so, consequently, our well water was contaminated. I couldn't believe that nobody was, you know, raising all kinds of holy hell about it, but nobody was saying a word. It was very, very a quiet thing, and only really a very few people actually knew about it. So I started asking questions, and I found out that some of those chemicals that were in our water were very similar to some of the chemicals that I had been selling for all those years. My son was about 12 years old at that time, and his name was Trey. And every day when I took him to school or took him back home from school, we had to cross the Finn Holloway River, and that's the river that's so polluted from the mill. And he would look at me and he would say, Mama, why don't you make him clean up that river? It's so nasty, it's so black, and it's so ugly, it's so polluted. You know, kids think you can do everything in the world, and I just kind of passed it off for a while there, and I said, yeah, sure, Trey, you know, I'll get to that. That'll be my next project. He kept on at me until I really did get interested in it. And so I started asking questions. I made a trip to the DER, and of course they didn't want to talk to me. And I made a trip up to Atlanta to the EPA, and they pretty much wanted to just brush me aside and get me out of there. But the more I learned, the more upset I became, and the more convinced I was that we had a really, really bad problem in Taylor County with the river. So that's what got me started on all my environmental work. I found out that I remember the day in 1986 that I found out that the dioxin that was being sent out from the mill in the effluent was exactly the same chemical as Agent Orange. And that was a very depressing day for me, because back then there was hardly anybody for me to talk to at home about that kind of thing. You know, nobody wanted to talk to me about it. It was a taboo subject in Taylor County. You just didn't criticize the mill because that was where everybody worked, the main source of income for people there, the only big employer in the county. And you just didn't really want to criticize them very much, or you'd be blacklisted. And when I finally did sort of come out of the closet about it and become vocal about it, the local paper called me an armed radical environmental terrorist. And when they called me that, I knew I was doing the right thing. I knew I was making points and doing what I should be doing. I was on the right track. I met Onis years ago. We've been to several environmental meetings together. We were at the dioxin meeting in Tallahassee years ago together. We were both at the Cassini demonstration back in 89. We've been to several different kinds of environmental and peace meetings through the years, and I'm so pleased to be with y'all today.
Joy, in today's program introduction, I mentioned that you and your community organization, HOPE, Help Our Polluted Environment, is involved in a number of issues in addition to the Buckeye paper mill that we've been talking about. One is the U.S. military's plan to locate a cruise missile bombing range in your area. Another major threat is a proposed 800-megawatt coal-fired power plant. As you and many of our worldwide listeners know, coal power plants emit very toxic pollutants that are harmful to the environment and human health. Burning coal releases microscopic particles containing lead, sulfur, mercury, arsenic, and uranium. According to a December 1978 article in Science magazine, people living near coal-fired power plants are exposed to higher radiation doses than those living near nuclear power plant. Organizations such as the Union of Concerned Scientists and the American Lung Association are very concerned about serious detrimental impacts of coal-fired power plants. Even U.S. Environmental Protection Agency's Inspector General Nikki Tinsley disputed recent comments from EPA Administrator Leavitt that the nation's air quality has improved and will be, quote, cleaner, unquote, under President Bush's energy policy emphasis of increasing the use of coal for electric power. We both know that the Clean Water Act and Clean Air Act have been severely weakened under the Bush-Cheney administration. There is little, if any, environmental monitoring or enforcement of pollution regulations by either federal or state government agencies. Increased use of coal will also greatly increase the problems of global climate change, which the White House does not seem to care about. Increasing coal use will also require more destruction of Mother Earth from mining coal. much of which will further desecrate sacred Indian land, which has already been made into a, quote, national sacrifice area, unquote. Joy, please share your thoughts about making Taylor County into a type of sacrifice zone.
Yeah, along with the bombing range that was proposed for Taylor County, they were going to move the Eglin Air Force bombing range over to Taylor County, and this front man named Alford that sort of took the heat in the press about being the instigator of this whole thing. When all this first came about last year, he offered to give Seminole Electric 1,500 acres if they would come to Taylor County and build a coal-fired power plant. So that would mean that we would have a polluting pulp mill, a bombing range, and a coal-fired power plant. And I said, you know, what's next? A hazardous waste incinerator and maybe a great big hazardous waste landfill? I mean, what else could they do to Taylor County? Is it just going to be a total sacrifice area? Let's just give up on it because it's already polluted, seemed to be the attitude. And I'm thinking, how am I going to fight all this off at one time? You know, but when you're involved in these kind of battles, you're thinking, wow, you know, this is probably going to be more than I can deal with. Fortunately, some people came forward, the people that would be most affected in the Ikenfeni River area about the bombing range came forward, and they were very much against the coal-fired power plant also. You know, we already have enough mercury from the pulp mill. I mean, the fish in the river are terribly affected by contaminated with mercury already. The shellfish, the fish and the shellfish on the coast. The air is already polluted. We're the 57th worst air pollution in the whole nation. So we don't need a coal-fired power plant if you're just looking at it in the context of air pollution and water pollution. Of course, you know, our county commissioners are very much for this coal-fired power plant because it's going to mean about 300 jobs. And God knows it doesn't make any difference how much pollution you have as long as you have 200 or 300 jobs. Well, I don't think jobs justify pollution. If you're going to put it in that kind of a context, then let's charge for every dollar of for every gallon of water they use. Let's charge for every pound of pollution that they put into the air, into the water. Make them pay if that's what they're going to do. Nobody's ever really done that. Make them pay for the ailments that they cause. Make them pay for every fish they contaminate. There's got to be a trade-off somewhere, I realize, for people to have jobs. But I think that in this day and time, we could, the companies themselves should develop ways to generate electricity that are not nuclear powerhouses nor coal-fired power plants. You know, we have the sun in Florida that warms us, and we could make solar energy so easily. And we live on the coast. We generally have a breeze. Why can't we use wind for generating power? There are so many new ways that are energy conservation would be a smart thing to do. Let's start using driving cars that are, you know, more environmentally friendly. There are so many things that we could do. Let's just each save on electricity every way we can. That's not to say that it's every person's fault that all this pollution has taken place and is taking place. What I found is that these big companies that are polluters want to turn it around and say it's all our fault, whereas they are the ones that are causing the pollution, and they should be held responsible for doing this, whereas each one of us then should be environmentally conscious enough to save every way that we possibly can and be aware of what we're doing with our actions. You know, turn off the water when you're brushing your teeth, and don't just waste water. But at the same time, the pulp and paper mill shouldn't be allowed to dirty 80, 90 million gallons of water a day. So all of us that are wasting water brushing our teeth, all combined together, don't even make a drop in the bucket compared as to what the pulp and paper mills dirty every day. But I do think that we each have our own personal responsibility to do all that we can to save the environment. You were talking about the forestry practices. The pine trees that they grow nowadays don't even have a heart in them. They are genetically engineered trees. They are total cellulose. What they are is paper-making trees, pulp-making trees. They're not suitable to help any kind of wildlife. They don't produce pine cones. So there's nothing that they produce that is helpful to the environment.
They don't help the climate and meteorology.
No, they talk about how much oxygen they add, how much oxygen they add to the air and how much they clean the air. And it's interesting you said something about the longleaf pine. That is native to Florida. But unfortunately, the pulp and paper mills and the lumber mills have cut so many longleaf pine that now some of the foresters are starting to encourage people to grow longleaf pine. Wow, that's pretty smart. You know, you can burn where longleaf pine grow, you can control burn to keep down the vegetation, so then you don't have these raging forest fires that you have when fires take off in these planted pines that are just planted for pulp and paper mills. The pines that they grow for pulp and paper mills can't be control burned because they can't stand the ash, the black soot that's on these trees when they go to make the paper from them. That makes a very poor quality cellulose, and they want it to be very, very white and very, very clean, supposedly clean. I'll put that in quotation marks. Because if it's bleached with chlorine and chlorine dioxide, it's not clean, it's dirty. But it's interesting about their forestry practices now. They plant these pine plantations, and they go in and they clear cut them, and they immediately plant them back again, and they use herbicides and insecticides. And now they're having to start to fertilize them because they don't grow back because they've depleted the soil. All the foresters now have suddenly decided that maybe it might be a real good idea to plant some longleaf pine back. Well, I think it really is, too, because you can control burn them. They make pine cones. They will regenerate themselves. It's a smarter tree all the way around to be working with. The other part of that is that when they clear cut, they cut into the hardwood growth. Every time that they clear cut, they cut into it a little bit more, a little bit more. They cut more cypress. Now they're just taking the cypress trees that grow, take hundreds of years to grow, and mulching them up for mulch for people's yards. If you were going to pick a mulch to use, it'd be much smarter to use pine straw because that's a renewable thing. It doesn't really harm the pine trees or the soil if you rake up the straw underneath them and use them in people's yards for mulch. It makes a great mulch. But when you have to cut down a cypress tree that takes hundreds of years to grow to full maturity and just use it for a season in your yard for mulch, that just doesn't seem to make sense to me.
Joy, before we continue our conversation, I wanted to let our worldwide audience know, as many do know, I'm a forest ecologist by profession, and I've devoted much of my life to the protection and well-being of world's forests. And when I moved to Florida some nearly 18 years ago, here in Southwest Florida, I was shocked to learn that Southwest Florida was the largest commercial exporter of timber in the world for almost a decade. And that if you look at the history of, for example, the railroads in particular, you'll know that they really were built in order to escalate the amount of logging. In fact, this area that we live in, Pahiogi, as Seminole and Miccosukee people, the indigenous peoples here, call this part of the Western Everglades. This area under the National Park Service is called Big Cypress Preserve. And they were called Big Cypress not only because the trees were once very beautiful, we call grandfathers, sacred to us Native people as being very big, but the surface area, much of the Western Everglades region, were beautiful ancient cypress trees, and they were devastated. And I remember some time ago calculating the number of trains that used to carry timber from the so-called Big Cypress Swamps, from Chokoloskee and Everglades City to the mills in what's now called Central Florida. So when we talk about forestry, we're not, a lot of times people think about the Pacific Northwest or the Great Lakes, or even where I come from, what's now called the Northeast of New England, which also went through a timber holocaust. It's very important for people to realize that this subtropical ecosystem and temperate tropical ecosystem of North Florida was one of the most beautifully diverse forest ecosystems in the world, and within a matter of less than a century, it's been devastated.
little bird, where do you fly to? When every season's rolled into one, hey kangaroo, where do you run to? Why, listen for the sound of the man with a gun, the hunter's gun. Mother Nature keeps on crying, tears of rain from the sky. It makes you wonder about tomorrow. Is Mother Earth getting ready to die? Is Mother Earth going to die? Long, long ago, in a dream time, our Mother Earth, she was beautiful and new. Then changes came to the landscape. Now there's cities, farms, and factories on you. There's a mess on you. Mother Nature keeps on crying, tears of rain from the sky. It makes you wonder about tomorrow. Is Mother Earth getting ready to die? Is Mother Earth going to die? Little children of tomorrow, I hope you find a better way to live, to a better day. Mother Nature keeps on crying, tears of rain from the sky. It makes you wonder about tomorrow. Is Mother Earth getting ready to die? Mother Nature keeps on crying, tears of rain from the sky. It makes you wonder about tomorrow. Is Mother Earth getting ready to die? Is Mother Earth going to die? Is Mother Earth getting ready to die? Is Mother Earth going to die?
I know you studied agriculture, and one of the concerns I have is the whole area called GMO, genetically modified organisms, and we just started to kind of touch on that iceberg a moment ago when we were talking about these timber plantations or tree farms. They're not really even trees. They don't grow in soil. They grow in a agro growth medium, and it's very frightening. You've had experience working with farmers in the South earlier on in your career. One of the things that scare me greatly is some of the things, for example, that Monsanto and other big companies are doing, Archer Daniels Midland, with this whole genetic manipulation of life, of crop agriculture, kind of forcing a so-called green revolutionary technology on the agricultural world stage using genetic engineering. Do you want to talk anything about that?
I'm sure that Norman Borlaug, who actually started the Green Revolution in Mexico way back years and years ago, never really thought that things would turn out the way they are today with agriculture. But the Mexican, the Mayan, the Inca people knew actually more about growing corn than we know now. and they knew how to do it naturally and how to pick the varieties that would grow best in areas. They were so far ahead of many, many of our great environmental leaders now that it's interesting to look back over the history of agriculture and see how things have changed or not progressed maybe the way they should have. Maybe we should have gone backwards and learned how they really did things a long time ago rather than going willy-nilly forth the way we do now. The way that things are changing in agriculture with genetically modified organisms is pretty frightening thing. When you think about your food not being natural, about it being some man-made, some concocted seed and some hybrid seed that you can't keep the seed and regrow the next year, it's actually against the law to keep these genetically modified seeds. You can't save that seed. The Monsanto will have you arrested and put in jail. You'll be stopped from farming if you do that. And that is kind of a thing that totally goes against the grain of most honest, good farmers. You know, for centuries, people have saved their own seed. And it seems to be something that's just totally unnatural about this. And I can't see that it's going to end up to be anything good. My learning about all this has taught me that when you plant the same type of seed, this grow the same kind of plant over a very, very large area, that you're just asking for trouble. There's going to be some pest or some disease or some virus or something that is going to cause you to have crop failure. You're supposed to plant a variety of different seeds. You're supposed to plant seeds that are not hybrids so that they can breed true the next time you plant those seeds. It's a natural thing to do. My thoughts are on this that we are leading ourselves down a very, very dangerous path with these genetically modified organisms and hybrid seeds, that we should be saving the old varieties because one day we're going to have to go back to them to depend on them for our foods and our feed for our animals. And that's another whole issue about steroids and antibiotics and all of these food added feed additives that they give to feedlot animals. The way that beef and pork and chicken poultry is raised now is just really pretty frightening when you come right down to it. It's not natural anymore. And anything that's not natural is sooner or later going to be met with some terrible disaster.
You are listening to Wolf Mountain Native American Radio's Honoring Mother Earth Indigenous Voices. This is your host, Oness. I'm going to ask my friend and guest, Joy, a question that has been a major concern to us here at Yakitishi Native Center for many years and is an effort of mine trying to build coalitions between so-called minority environmental community and mainstream conservationists, the environmental justice movement. And as many of our worldwide listeners know, part of the reason why the environmental justice movement had to be created was the fact that people of color, or I like the word people of culture, were actually sabotaged by many of the mainstream conservation environmental groups who really did not want to work in coalition with so-called minority environmental issues. Now, here in the year 2005, there's been a lot of changes in the environmental movement, conservation community. One of the concerns I'd like to talk about with you is how some of the well-established organizations have really been co-opted, really are no longer acting in the best interest of the environment or even the rural communities that they supposedly are there to assist.
Well, this is very interesting because some of the better known groups have done some things that are at least what you would say is questionable. Over the last 15 or 20 years, a lot of the land along the coastline up in North Florida, say from Cedar Key on around to the west, it was owned by the timber companies, Procter & Gamble, St. Joe, for instance. And what they did was they went in and they cut over a lot of that land, cut the timber that they wanted off of it, turned around and sold a lot of that land to the Nature Conservancy, which, you know, back during that time we all thought was pretty much on our side, right? Well, what's happened now is that the Nature Conservancy has turned around and at a nice profit sold that same land to the state. It's one thing to call yourself a conservationist and another thing to actually be one. There's a big difference there. Some of this land that I'm talking about in North Florida now, say that the Thousand Friends of Florida has come in, and they want to establish a greenway across North Florida. Well, supposedly that's to keep it green and to control development. Actually, what they're doing is working hand in hand with the military to establish a pathway for bombers and jets and fighter planes to have a safe, call it a flyway, a path, a corridor across North Florida. And that's not really conservation. I don't call that conservation at all. I don't call that being environmentally aware or environmentally safe. You know, if you're going to conserve something, really conserve it and save the environment there. Don't just say that's what you're doing and call it a pretty name and then actually have it be something else. So I've found a lot of fault with the Nature Conservancy in that they have made a lot of money in not buying the land at a cheap price from the timber companies. $800 or $900 an acre, $1,000 an acre for cut over timberland is a pretty steep price to pay. But then they would turn it and sell it for twice that amount to the state. And that's people's tax money at work. So I think if more people knew that, they would question these environmental, so-called environmental organizations like the Nature Conservancy and 10,000 Friends of Florida, or 1,000 Friends of Florida, excuse me, and question exactly what it is that they're doing. If they're going to be environmental groups, then they should be real environmental groups and not just call themselves that. It's kind of like Bush's Blue Sky Initiative. You know, you call it a pretty name, but then you actually turn it and make rules that are exactly the opposite. And a lot of these kind of groups that we're talking about are being totally co-opted by politicians, by people who call themselves conservationists but really are not. And I'm very concerned about this. Those groups are not what your local environmental activist kind of people want to be involved with. That's just not what we stand for.
listening to Honoring Mother Earth, Indigenous Voices, a production of the Yat-Kidichi Native Center. Yat-Kidichi Native Center defends Mother Earth and the cultural lifeways of Indigenous peoples throughout the world. Yat-Kidichi Native Center is an intertribal, culture and arts, environmental protection, social justice, and news media organization. Yat-Kidichi Native Center portrays Native peoples and their world views in a more accurate and in-depth depiction of both our ancestral and contemporary cultures. Yat-Kidichi Native Center serves to educate by providing a deeper understanding of our diverse cultures, arts, values, histories, and contemporary situations. Yat-Kidichi tries to honor traditional ways by instilling an appreciation and respect for Mother Earth and tribal peoples throughout the world. Yat-Kidichi Native Center educates the public on important issues facing Indigenous communities. We work in support of intertribal, cultural, environmental, and social justice issues by networking with other organizations and events which share our concerns. Yat-Kidichi Native Center serves as a focal point for Native news and information. We maintain a documentary library for networking with the Native and international press. Yat-Kidichi Native Center's Speakers Bureau provides spokespersons for school programs, conference speakers, and community presentations. Yat-Kidichi Native Center is experienced in planning, promoting Native forums, symposiums, powwows, and cultural events. Yat-Kidichi's Mishkwinatake Environment Program protects Mother Earth through conservation and restoration projects. Yat-Kidichi's Environmental Education Program focuses on curriculum development, teacher training, and nature field trips. We are members of the professional organization, the North American Association of Environmental Education. Yat-Kidichi's Kinonwatakwisi Native Arts creates quality handcrafted traditional and contemporary fine arts. Please request our catalog of custom flutes, pottery, beaded necklaces, bracelets, earrings, leather pouches, hat bands, and chokers with bone. Yat-Kidichi Native Center's Wolf Mountain Radio Program, Honoring Mother Earth Indigenous Voices, honors Native American and Indigenous peoples throughout the world by being a voice for our ancestors, contemporary, and future generations. Please write us for our catalog of audio tapes available for purchase. Native peoples throughout the world are concerned for the well-being of sacred Mother Earth, tribal sovereignty, and respect for cultural lifeways. If you appreciate hearing Honoring Mother Earth Indigenous Voices, we ask you, our listeners, to help financially support our program to stay on the air. Wolf Mountain Radio is an all-volunteer production. Any financial contribution to Honoring Mother Earth Indigenous Voices will be greatly appreciated. We thank you for listening to Honoring Mother Earth Indigenous Voices. We welcome your comments and suggestions. Please feel free to contact us about our consulting services, or if you or your organization is interested in hosting a speaker or educational forum. To contact Yat-Kidichi Native Center, write to Yat-Kidichi Native Center, 1731 16th Avenue Northeast, Naples, Florida, 34120, USA. Yat-Kidichi Native Center sincerely thanks you. Aho, Kinawatakwisin, to all of our relations.
The music you heard prior to our Yat-Kidichi Native Center program identification was a Native American flute song from Robert Tree Cody and Obiah Edwards from Canyon Records CD, Voices Across the Canyon, Volume 6. The title of that song was Maize, honoring our sister corn, a very sacred plant to Indigenous peoples around the world. And we started off our music set from Aborigine singer-songwriter Johnny Huckle with his song, Is Mother Earth Going to Die? Well, dear friends, we're nearing the end of our broadcast time together for this edition of Wolf Mountain Native Radio. Next week on Honoring Mother Earth, Indigenous Voices, we shall continue my conversation interview with environmental community activist Joy Ezell. If you want to find out more about the work that Joy Ezell and her organization, HOPE, Help Our Polluted Environment, is doing, you can look at their website, hopeforcleanwater@yahoogroups.com. Once again, you can check out HOPE's website, Help Our Polluted Environment, at hopeforcleanwater@yahoogroups.com. We're going to conclude today's program with a Native radio news segment from Radio for Peace International's Progressive News Network, a segment on ecological changes. I want to thank you for listening to Wolf Mountain Native Radio's Honoring Mother Earth, Indigenous Voices. This is your host and producer, Ones Pritzker. Aho, Kinoan Wantakwasin, to all of our relations.
Over the past 20 years, scientists have been baffled by the disappearance of frogs and other amphibians throughout the world, even though indigenous peoples have noted such environmental declines for years. PNN's Steve Tingley has more.
Why are all the frogs dying? This is the question scientists have been pondering for years, as frogs and other amphibians such as salamanders, toads, and newts are facing massive die-offs. The Australian Broadcasting Corporation recently had a feature about the disappearing frogs, along with some possible explanations, including disease and environmental destruction. Australian scientists have joined the world effort to attempt to solve this so-called environmental mystery of the drastic decline of frog numbers. Many scientists acknowledge that frogs and other amphibians are important and vital creatures in ecosystems, and that large declines in populations, as well as extinctions of species, is believed to be a clear warning sign of wider environmental problems. In what is now called Queensland, Australia, an Aboriginal homeland, park officials have noted the severe problem of frog disappearance as the local scientists search for answers. One official said, quote, "Especially in the wet tropics here, the number of species gone missing and the population declines have been most dramatic," end quote. Right here in Costa Rica, the golden toad, which used to occupy highland forests near Monteverde, has become extinct. The formerly cool, moist habitat of the golden toad has changed to a warmer and drier place with fewer mists and higher clouds. The result is that the beautiful golden toad fell prey to infection due to the warmer temperatures there. And at the heart of the problem of frog disappearance lies the question of what is the real cause. For example, Australian scientists have discovered and identified two diseases that are causing frog die-offs. One is a fungal infection in Australia, United States, and Central and South America. The other is a viral infection in the United States, Canada, and the United Kingdom. These diseases are possibly the results of environmental damage by humans. Scientists have noted how the increase of greenhouse gases like carbon dioxide poured out of exhaust pipes and other forms of fossil fuel burning has contributed to rising temperatures in the world. This climate change has allowed infections to enter new habitats. Frogs and toads around the world are showing abnormal deformities and skin lesions as a result of their sensitivity to rising temperatures and increased exposure to ultraviolet radiation. But the problem is not only climate change. As production byproducts and other pathogens are introduced into new habitats and wildlife populations, diseases in frogs, as well as other animals, become more common. But enough technical talk. The fact is, frogs and other plants and animal species are dying on a worldwide scale, and as science searches for answers and asks why, indigenous peoples throughout the world have witnessed firsthand environmental destruction for years. Scientists call the loss of frog species a mystery, but it is not hard for traditional indigenous people like Ones, a Native American ecologist and journalist, to speak on the concerns of this environmental destruction. Ones?
Akwe, greetings, that's how we say hello. Thank you for listening. Native peoples throughout the world are concerned for the well-being of sacred Mother Earth. Indigenous cultural life ways are based on honoring Mother Earth, caring for all life. In my Wabanaki language, we say, Kinawantakwasin, to all of our relations. This word expresses our reverence for our relatives of the natural world, in what in English is called the environment. Native peoples consider the animals and plants, trees, birds, fish, and marine life as our brothers and sisters. We are to care for Mother Earth, what you call the environment. Throughout the world, indigenous peoples have lived with nature from the time of our creation, as the Aborigines call our dream time. In our cultural ways, we have developed a detailed knowledge of our relatives, the habitats of fauna and flora. Our physical survival and spiritual ceremonies are based on the animals and plants from whom we love and honor. In this regard, Native peoples understand our ecosystems very well. Traditional knowledge is passed down through our generations on the well-being of Mother Earth and what threats are impacting nature. Native elders are very concerned about the environment, the destruction of Mother Earth, the loss of plant and animal species. We have witnessed firsthand ecological impacts from pollution, the destruction of forests, the advancement of desertification, death of marine life, and general changes due to what scientists call global warming. Some of the examples that you might be concerned about is your story talks about frogs are a prime example of these sensitive individual species we call indicator species in biology. Within my own Native American community, for example, we have very specific examples that have been reported in the media about frogs. In my own homeland, the Wabanaki Territory, it was now called the Northeast United States, Southern Canada, our sacred tree, the maple trees, are dying. In the Arctic, caribou, for example, have been reported going blind. There was a very important conference in Albuquerque in 1998, co-sponsored by NASA, National Aeronautic Space Administration. One of their offices invited traditional Native elders from different parts of the world, many North American Indians as we're called, to present testimony on some of our traditional knowledge and observations to the natural world and some of the ecological impacts that we have witnessed. Some of the Yupik and Inupiaq people you call Eskimo, the circumpolar peoples, have talked about the loss of glacial ice, for example, that the ice packs are not forming so long. They're taking much shorter periods of time, and the ice is not thick. That might not sound very important to some people, but the thickness and duration of the northern ice fields is the habitat of the animals and plants that my brothers and sisters in the north depend upon. The beautiful polar bear, Arctic marine life, seals and walrus and birds, ducks, and some of the other animals and plants that my relatives depend upon in my own homeland, their habitats have been disrupted as a result of this issue of global warming and impact to the ozone layer. There are holes in the ozone from what we've heard now in Antarctica. And so there's very visible signs from the animal and plant life that their life cycles are being disrupted, and that directly threatens the cultural survival of many indigenous peoples and native peoples throughout the world. We're kind of like the miner's canary. What happens to us first is basically going to happen to all the other human beings.
Thank you, Ernest. Is there anything else you would like to say?
I just want to re-express our sincere word, that is, Kinuwantakusin, to all of our relations.
Thank you, Ernest. Reporting for PNN, this is Steve Tingley.